Bin Laden was George Sr.'s clan not so long ago. Set George up with a retirement plan, lots of low tax dough. Go down White House, way down in payoff land. Tell the CIA, leave the Saudis alone. There's oil and gas in Uzbekistan. Oil and gas must flow. So we depose the Taliban. Where'd Osama go? Bend down Congress, kneel down and lend a hand. Tell the people liberty must go. There's more to gain in war than peace. Let the weapons flow. Destabilize the Middle East, enrich the CEO. Go down, brother, way down on Florida sand. Tell the justices not to let my people vote. The VP had a heart attack, oily blood, you know. While he's still here, let's bomb Iraq, give the rubes a show. Lie down, people, lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go. The opium crop was blown away. Let them poppies grow. Thanks to U.S. troops, it's back today. Only goes to show. Go down Wall Street, sell off my shares today. Tell my broker, put it all in blow.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just catching this broadcast, we're listening to Should We Prohibit Genetically Engineered Babies?
Our motion is prohibit genetically engineered babies, and here to summarize her position against this motion, against prohibition, Nita Farahani. She is a professor at Duke Law and a research professor at Duke's Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy.
This debate is quite personal to me, and I'd like to share why with you. In 2001, I attended the wedding of a dear friend. 2 years later, she developed thyroid cancer, and she underwent radioactive iodine treatment. The next year, when she and her husband started to try to have children, she learned that she had substantial mitochondrial abnormalities that she would pass on to each and every one of her children. She underwent mitochondrial transfer and now has a beautiful and healthy son made possible by this technology. We don't know if the radioactive iodine caused those abnormalities. What we do know is that she now has a child, healthy, active, and bright, from a technology that is available and we have already used. In 2010, I also received radioactive iodine therapy for thyroid cancer. When I'm ready to have children, I hope that I also have the option of having a healthy child with whatever the best technology is that we have available to us today. I'm not here to defend every type of genetic engineering, and I don't think we're ready as a society to embrace it all. But we already know that there are certain forms of genetic engineering that are safe and effective to use. And what I urge you to do is vote against the resolution, to vote in favor of scientific progress, to vote to enable each of us as private citizens to make private choices in the most intimate choice we will ever make in life, to bring healthy children into this world. Thank you.
Thank you, Nita Farahani. Our motion is prohibit genetically engineered babies, and here to summarize his position in support of the motion to prohibit, Robert Winston. He is a professor of science and society and emeritus professor of fertility studies at Imperial College London.
Ladies and gentlemen, don't be seduced by a single very heart-rending story. That is really not at issue here. There's a big issue for the whole of our society and for people in general. I regret to say that I'm saddened to see this simplistic argument about mitochondrial DNA from the other side. We don't understand the interactions in the egg with the mitochondria, and already we've seen a number of horrid mishaps. So, of course, maybe a particular individual was lucky, but they might have been unlucky. How different we would have been then. We've heard that people have a right to have a healthy child. Of course, they don't have a right, sadly, to have a healthy child. What we do have a right to, though, in a democratic society, surely, is to have access to the best and the safest treatment. And at the moment, the safest treatment is certainly not meddling with the genome. It is actually to look at every other way of dealing with these terrible diseases. And it's worth bearing in mind, too, that we're not going to eradicate genetic defects by doing this, not remotely. New defects occur all the time. As Lee Silver rightly points out, all of us have defective DNA. 30% of boys born with the male form of muscular dystrophy have this as a new mutation, as he well knows. No amount of pre-implantation diagnosis would have changed that. The question is how we deal with these diseases, actually, when we have them.
Thank you, Robert Winston. And that concludes our closing statements, and now it is time to learn which side you feel has argued the best. I want to say that this has been a spectacularly well-argued debate by both sides. I just want to invite a round of applause for them for what they did. All right. We now have the final results in. Remember, you voted twice before the debate and again after hearing the arguments. The team that changes the most minds in a percentage way will be declared our winner. The motion is prohibit genetically engineered babies. Let's look at the results for the team that was arguing for this motion to prohibit. Before the debate, 24% agreed, 30% were against, and 46% were divided. That was the preliminary vote for everybody. Now let's look at the vote that the team arguing for the motion received in the second vote. The team arguing for the motion, the second vote is 41%. That's an increase of 17%. That is the number that the other team needs to beat. It needs to beat 17%. Let's see how the other team did. Before, they were 30%. They went up to 49%. That's a 19% difference. They just squeaked by. The team arguing against prohibition of genetically engineered babies carries this debate. Our congratulations to them. Thank you from me, John Donvan, and Intelligence Squared US. We'll see you next time.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on the court from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Coming up next, Andy Worthington discusses Guantanamo with Scott Horton. Andy Worthington is the author of The Guantanamo Files and the article 11 Years After 9/11, Guantanamo is a Political Prison.
All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I keep my interview archives from this and my other radio shows at scotthorton.org. Tonight's guest is Andy Worthington, America's great chronicler of the Guantanamo Bay Prison. Unfortunately, we don't have an American that actually does the work. Andy's a Brit, but I sure am glad we have him. He's the author of the book The Guantanamo Files and the producer of the movie Outside the Law. He keeps a website at andyworthington.co.uk and is a policy advisor to the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org, where his most recent piece is 11 Years After 9/11, Guantanamo is a Political Prison. Welcome to the show, Andy. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us tonight.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
All right, so this is an article full of bummers. I guess, to start with, just like in the title, here we are 11 years later, and this Guantanamo prison, which everyone knows now, we've certainly covered this on this and other shows, this prison that started out really as a publicity stunt for the terror war to make it look like there were more than a couple of hundred terrorists in the whole wide world that we needed to be concerned with, they just, basically bought whoever the Pakistani military was selling for their bounty just to fill the thing up and pretend like there actually really was some Islamo-fascist caliphate out there with this army that had to be dealt with. And now here we are 11 years later, and there are still people held there. Some of them, you know, perhaps actually guilty of something, but many more, as you write in this article, have already been cleared for release and yet still are not released. So I guess let's start with them. Who are they? Those at Guantanamo Bay who have been cleared for release for this, that, or another reason, and yet are still held there.
Well, you know, Scott, the majority of those guys, two-thirds of them are Yemenis. The others are, we don't know exactly because the Obama administration hasn't deigned to let us have any information about exactly who they are, and lawyers are pretty much prevented from talking about it. They're not allowed to say whether their clients are cleared for release or not. That's all classified information. Some of them are Syrians. There are still a couple of Chinese guys in there, Uyghurs from China, but mainly, you know, the biggest group there are the Yemenis who have been cleared for release. Some of these guys' military review boards under the Bush administration as long ago as 2004 said, these guys can go home. We're finished interrogating them. We don't regard them as a threat to the United States. That's 8 years. 8 years that they've been held since you know, people in a position of power and authority said these guys can go home. President Obama continued the policy that President Bush had of being very suspicious of the situation in Yemen. Basically, President Bush did release, I think somewhere around 15 Yemenis, that figure, less than two dozen certainly. Compare that to about 100 Saudis that President Bush released, and there were roughly the same number of Saudis and Yemenis at Guantanamo. And that's because the Saudi government is a great ally of the United States, and eventually the negotiations took place whereby the Saudis said, hey, we need our guys back, how are we going to do this? Whereas that didn't happen with Yemen, and under Obama it didn't happen with Yemen either. But what happened in the first year that Obama was in power, his administration started transferring some Yemenis back. And I think seven guys were sent back in 2009. And then at the end of that year, a Nigerian man called Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab was caught trying to bomb a plane with a bomb in his underwear. And there was a huge backlash because it turned out that he had apparently been recruited in Yemen. Huge backlash against Yemen, a kind of ultimatum from Congress to the president saying, that's it, you mustn't release any Yemenis from Guantanamo. And instead of saying, hey, what of these guys who've been in Guantanamo for years, cleared, some of them cleared by President Bush's people in 2004, what have they got to do with this supposed terror problem that we have in Yemen? He said, yeah, that's fine. I'm not going to release any Yemenis. And no one has been released since. So, you know, we're now getting on for 3 years since the president put this moratorium in place. Nobody really seems to care. Nobody seems to want to do anything about it. I think the only thing that's worse than holding people arbitrarily, Scott, is telling them that they've been through one kind of review process or another and that they're going to be released and then not releasing them. I would rather be held arbitrarily by the bad guy who just says to me, you're not going anywhere, sunshine, that's the end, rather than have somebody who pretends that there are notions of fairness and justice and then flouts them. And that's what the United States has been doing with the Yemenis in Guantanamo in various ways for at least 8 years.
Mm. Well, you know, it's funny. I don't know all the exact statements, but I think if people go back and look at the campaign season of 2007 and 2008, they might remember that Barack Obama won not just on the position that he was going to close Guantanamo, which was certainly part of it, but it was really the entire package. I mean, that was really Barack Obama's mandate, was undoing the last 8 years of, whoops, we all wish that really hadn't happened with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the Republicans. And so This was the American people's way of, one, apologizing to the world for that, and two, trying to undo it, trying to, you know, assuming, I think a lot of people really did assume with all that hope and change and all that stuff, that they really were going to see an end to these policies rather than an escalation of the power grab, where now Obama claims not just the power to kidnap and torture Americans like George Bush did with Jose Padilla, but even the power to murder Americans, as he's done with Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that symptomatic of what happens when something as unprecedented as the power grab that took place under Bush happened. And instead of doing what you said you were going to do, which was, you know, we need to rewind the clock back to before all this began and behave in a much more responsible and acceptable and law-abiding manner, it hasn't. You know, whether it's been deliberate or whether it's been just as a product of not challenging what took place, it has in so many ways been a continuation. And, you know, and Guantanamo is certainly a key part of that. I mean, you know, what's significant to me, Scott, has always been that, yeah, there were a handful of bad guys in Guantanamo involved with international terrorism. We know there are people there allegedly involved in the 9/11 attack. We know from Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who I spoke to a few years ago, that, you know, essentially he was told that when they transferred Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and this handful of high-value detainees into Guantanamo in 2006, that was the point at which, with a straight face, the administration could say, we are actually holding some bad guys in Guantanamo, because they didn't have anybody who was any higher than medium level in any terrorist capacity in Guantanamo, and they only had a few dozen at most of these people out of nearly 800. So, you know, the problem
is... because anyone that they were really interested in, Andy, they were holding at a black site in Morocco or in Poland or Romania or in Thailand or Diego
Garcia.
But you
see, what upsets me, Scott, really, is not just that we've had innocent men in Guantanamo, and we still, I believe, do. I mean, they're not dressed up as that. The alleged evidence against them extracted by all kinds of dubious means suggests that they're not innocent. But we also, fundamentally, we have people in Guantanamo who were fighting with the Taliban against the Northern Alliance before the 9/11 attacks, because, you know, mainly because some sheikh back at home had told them that the Taliban were trying to establish a pure Islamic state and they should go out there and fight. Now, you know, we can discuss whether we think that was a good idea or not, but what it certainly wasn't was terrorism. And after the 9/11 attacks, what the Bush administration got away with, and what hasn't been repudiated because these guys are still held, is this notion that, you know, the people that were rounded up in connection with the military invasion of Afghanistan 11 years ago, we're nearly up to the 11th anniversary of that, those people that were captured are somehow terrorists, when actually very few of them were. What they were soldiers in a battle that had nothing to do with international terrorism. And these guys should have been held as prisoners of war, but we know that they weren't. They were held as enemy combatants. They still effectively are that, even though President Obama dropped that designation. Enemy combatants were conceived by the Bush administration as people without rights. And essentially, the people who are still in Guantanamo find themselves in that unenviable and very disturbing situation where they are still essentially held without right. They're not going anywhere. They're not going anywhere even if they're cleared. So it remains fundamentally disgraceful on that level. And I think it's very disappointing that it just dropped off the radar, really. The things that people understood when Bush was in were wrong, they've kind of forgotten about.
Mm-hmm. Well, and especially toward the end of the Bush years, it was finally getting through to people about blowback and about how history had begun actually back before September 11th. And there were, real earthly reasons that we had gotten into this mess in the first place, and then people were, hearing testimony from people like Matthew Alexander, the pseudonym of the American interrogator in Iraq, who spent years there interrogating people, and saying that other than the actual occupation of Iraq, the number two reason that anyone was, especially the foreigners he was talking about, the Libyans, the Syrians, the Saudis, who were traveling to Iraq to fight our guys, why were they doing so? It was because of Guantanamo Bay and because the pictures of the torture at Abu Ghraib. And this had replaced Palestine, had replaced the bombing of Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia as the number one, suicide bomber recruitment tool on earth. And the American people were finally, or especially the liberal Democrats, were starting to really, figure this out and use that explanation, that talking point against the Republicans. And yet somehow they decided to forget that as long as it's Barack Obama keeping it open. Or they make some lame excuse like, he's only the most powerful ruler of the most powerful empire in world history, and the poor guy is just helpless before the Congress that won't let him close it, which is such a despicable lie. He can order a war in Libya without Congress, but he can't order the troops at Guantanamo Bay to move and close that prison down? Please.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree, Scott, and, it undoubtedly is something that still burns throughout the Muslim world, and understandably, I traveled to Kuwait earlier this year, and I met people there who in a very, they weren't being firebrand about it. They were being very reasonable about it. But, they understood that that something had gone horribly wrong and that this situation remained something that was horribly wrong. And there's no way to go to a Muslim country and dress it up in any way other than the fact that this is a prison where the normal rules don't apply and all the prisoners are Muslims. So, it's a terrible thing to still have there. And, you are right that the ultimate responsibility lies with the president. But I have to say that every branch of the U.S. government has failed when it comes to Guantanamo, that both the major parties have failed when it comes to Guantanamo, that the courts have failed when it comes to Guantanamo.
The only difference there is the Republicans, their voters are glad that they're horrible on Guantanamo Bay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where...
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
And now for something completely different.